If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people. I'm all West Coast now.
And Mr. Justin Robert Young.
I am and continue to be West Coast.
Hey, I'm West Coast as well.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Dude, this is it. Weird Things has gone Hollywood. We're all left coast now.
I know. Let's talk about our Pilates and our vegan diet and our Bikram yoga we're going to go do later.
All right. Listen, calm down, Southern Californians. Up here in Northern California, I just feel like it's a little bit more European.
Yeah.
Do you want to know something weird? Hey, let me start off with one weird thing. This morning, I got like heavily pressured into buying a breakfast that I never in a million years would buy. It was vegan scrambled eggs that were made from garbanzo beans with a fake vegan hollandaise sauce and portobello mushrooms on a English muffin, and it was freaking exquisite. Like, I got bullied into it, and I was like, great, I guess I'm going home hungry. And instead, I was blown away. How's that for weird?
Man, welcome to every breakfast I've eaten for the last year since Ashley moved in. You have no idea how much I have eaten vegan food and have kind of really enjoyed it.
You guys are dead to me.
Oh, calm down. Calm down.
Just for that, I'm going over to Vicious Dogs right after this, and I'm getting myself the dead eye, the double bacon wrapped hot dog.
And keep in mind, like, that was my first question when I sat down. Like, I thought it was just a regular cafe that was highly rated on Urban Spoon. And so I'm like, do you have anything with bacon? And he goes, no. And it's like, I died a little bit inside, but instead it was really good.
So wait, the guy barked at you? The guy's like, yo, listen, if you're going to roll vegan, you got to roll with this fake-ass hollandaise sauce. No,
like, they had real eggs. Like, I gave up real – I could have ordered a burrito with real eggs and potatoes and other good stuff that I know I like. But instead, this guy's like, to be honest, I got to recommend, I am not vegan, but this thing is amazing. And then I'm like, yeah, okay, I don't really dig on vegan. And in fact, I even brought up – I was like, is it made, like, with fags, with, like, you know, the tofu stuff? He's like, no, bro, garbanzo beans. And all of a sudden, I was just barely intrigued. And then when it came time to order, he was like, yeah. In fact, I ordered something else. And the guy said, yeah, that menu is not active. Today it's Sunday brunch. And so I was like, well, shoot. And he's like, bro, this guy's like a former Marine. And he's like
doing diamond push-ups while he talks to you. Yes. You're actually sitting on his back.
I got to recommend this vegan scrambled eggs dish. And I was like, all right, what the heck? It's like, I just gave up, but man, am I glad I did. It was extraordinary.
Well, you want to plug it? Plug where you were at so people can go.
I'll have to look it up. It's I don't know, some joint. Who cares? It was Larry's Fishbowl Extravaganza.
Well, there we go.
Is that the, on the north side or the west side, Hilarious Fishbowl Extravaganza?
Hang on, I'm actually going to look now.
And since two-thirds of the show is in L.A., can we give driving directions between Vicious Dogs and Larry's Fishbowl?
Is that the one in Culver City? Or
the Rabbit Hole Cafe. That's what it was.
Wow. Very aptly named, gentlemen. Now may I proceed?
Yes.
We're going to leave the Rabbit Hole Cafe. And I got to tell you, my mind was blown. I saw this headline, and I'm like, man, if there is a Weird Things drinking game, you're going to be on the floor after this.
Yes!
Sasquatch has been tapped to fly in a SpaceX rocket while the Singularity pilots it.
You know what? It's kind of at that level. because it's one of these things where it has three components which just – I absolutely love, the third one being this enduring mystery that has to this day not been solved. And I thought perhaps with the collection of talent on this show, we, gentlemen, perhaps it is up to us to solve this mystery, because I can think of no other people more capable, well, foolhardy enough to try to solve this. And I'm going to pull up the actual item here. I just said, man, this is, it's like, I thought I was being trolled. I thought it was, because like you could create insert false articles or stuff like that if you gave somebody a bogus RSS feed. Anyhow, no need to get into that. I take you back to World War II, right? Now, middle of World War II, you've got intelligence agencies on both sides trying to figure out what the other parties are up to. What are they doing? What's going on, right? So we know you're trying to build secret weapons. There are installations and bases where you're testing things. You're bringing scientists around. You're shuffling generals around, trying to figure out the best strategies to win this war, to end all wars. Meanwhile, you've got, the Manhattan Project, most massive undertaking in the history of warfare as far as scientific battlefield technology, trying to split the atom in a controlled way to build the atomic bombs going on. And this is science fiction taking place. Then it's a big, huge project going on there. And there's an interesting article that came out about some guy, some Colorado newspaper, whatever, actually wrote about, hey, there's something interesting going on over in this place called the Manhattan Project or whatever in Texas. Or excuse me, in New Mexico, in Los Alamos, was just sort of wrote this sort of, I was down there, took a trip, and da-da-da-da-da. And that was, it never got picked up by any other paper after that.
Wow.
But that's not what we're here talking about.
No.
So, middle of World War II, 1941, Europe's in war, we're getting pulled into war. The German government, the Nazis, begin a massive importation, right? British MI5, weapons expert, is following everything they're doing and trying to keep track of what's going on. They're noticing shipments from around the world going into Germany.
Okay.
Now, I feel like if we had a time machine, I feel like Weird Things was just meant to live in the upside down, backwards, crazy world of World War II and Hitler chasing crazy supernatural powers.
So in reality, at some point, three of our forefathers were huddled in a London tube stop having these conversations.
My grandfather, who was in the European theater, who knows, maybe, perhaps. I don't know which side yours fought on, Justin, but
hey, Tony Anzalone, paratrooper in the Asian theater.
All right. For America. Okay.
For America. Yeah. For America.
Yeah. No, Anzalone.
I was about to say that's a very Italian sounding last name. I'm not sure how to feel.
Yes. So this is what was being imported, right? And this is MI5's trying to figure out, what do they need them for? What's going on? Why do the Nazis need this many?
Oh, crap.
Monkeys?
Really? Monkeys.
Yeah. Now, I have not heard this story, but it fascinates me, the idea of, well, our concept of Hitler, because, or the Nazi regime, because it's got to be in between somewhere, between, where we would think rational military thought and, like, the Looney Tunes caricature of the guy getting hit by the mallet, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's got to be somewhere in between there. And in that gray area, at some point, lives the rubber-stamped on Third Reich letterhead approval to purchase. How many monkeys, Andrew?
At least 1,000.
Oh, my God. And of what variety? Are these like rhesus monkeys?
Rhesus, but some Barbary apes, a few others. But, yeah, primarily rhesus monkeys.
Now, the most reasonable or rational way that you would use any number of monkeys, I would assume, would be maybe trials, medical trials?
Yeah. For a moment there, I thought they're actually like court trials in like a Nazi court of monkeys.
Exactly. To train them in the art of public defense.
Now, So because this is the Weird Things podcast, and my first thought, of course, was just like Justin's, it's got to be for clinical trials. But then I immediately thought of the horrific stories of the experiments against the Jews. And I guess I thought, okay, probably not for medical trials, which makes me think, like, were they I thought it was the story – tell me if I'm remembering this wrong, but wasn't there a story about Stalin trying to make monkey soldiers or half-human, half-monkey hybrids?
Yes, it was a project in, like, the 20s. And that was a Stalin was apparently documents showed that Ilya Ivanov was ordered to breed the mutant crossbreeds.
Oh my God! So was that Hitler's game plan? He's like, I don't know, that looks good to me.
We don't know. I mean, it could have been something as simple as, you know, like it was an IO9 article. He mentioned how the MI5 expert, the person MI5 spoke with, rather, had said, hey, listen, don't panic, you know, like. 500 hedgehogs were used to, you know, for, you know, foot and mouth disease tests. As far as why they need 1,000 rhesus monkeys in the middle of war, who knows? You know, it could be just some sort of, you know, boring sort of research. I prefer to think not. I imagine in my head some sort of Nazi super soldier testing that may have gone awry. And I think of Inglourious Bastards and wonder if there's a version out there to be made about monkeys.
Okay,
behind the lines.
You want to know? All right, here. I'm going to ask a question that is indeed very stupid, but has its place here on the Weird Things podcast, which is why this is a brilliant platform. How far have we gotten as a human culture with the concept of monkey soldiers? Like, what is the best? Like, what was the farthest that we got as most effective? And what are the fatal flaws to having a fleet of monkey soldiers best version?
Let's take it from another branch of the mammalian tree. Don't we have dolphins that are trained to find mines? Like, they put some kind of
water mines.
They actively use dolphins to protect protect battleships and naval hardware in other ports or in ports. So they'll keep dolphins. They have trained dolphins that go through there. And so that's a real program. They do that because they can search for divers underneath there. They can look for things on the bottom of the boats that shouldn't be attached there. So dolphins are used for that. As you all know, you know, canine units, dogs like that used a lot. And, you know, remember stories in India, they have places where they have tremendous problems with monkeys breaking into places and monkeys in these tourist areas.
Super smart, bro.
Yeah, the monkeys that will, like, pick pockets. Now they have monkeys that will steal change from you, then go to a vending machine, put the money into the vending machine.
No way.
Yes. Let me pull this up for you, okay? Meanwhile, with some of those monkeys, what the police have done is they actually have police monkeys they use to chase off the other monkeys.
All right, now tell me this. Back to the dolphins real quick, Andrew. Do you know what's the status on dolphins using language? Because I was thinking about this the other day. It seems like we should be very thankful that we've not made any contact with an alien culture right now, because it seems like between whales and dolphins and their alleged intelligence, if they do use some form of communication, which clearly, you know, clearly whales do, and their brains are complex enough that it seems like they could have some kind of language of their own. Wouldn't that be a great laboratory for us to practice? I mean, even if the level of intelligence is not what we think it is, the ability to break down an utterly alien form of communication, it seems like that would be good practice for when we make, when the green guys come.
Well, and widening the scope, Brian, there are already great minds asking, for example, what does the fox say?
Okay, I see.
So back to Brian. Here's the thing. Here's something to think about. Is that we obviously know that, like, we're finding out that, you know, animals communicate in very complex levels or ways. We find out elephants do this too. But, you know, we also have known for years, like, birds have particular calls, and that when it comes to meeting the green guys, it kind of depends on what context we do. Because one of the things that we realize about human language is it is humans that are successful are ones that are most able to exchange ideas to other humans. And you have people, when you have groups of people who have languages that are very narrowly defined and cultural standards that don't allow for a lot of exchange of ideas, they tend to atrophy and fall apart. And that's one of the, you know, the stories we learned from the rational optimist, you know, in like Tasmania. These people could build ships and stuff or boats to get to Tasmania, but then after several thousand years of isolation, by the time, you know, they made contact again with other people, they had rafts that were made of just weeds tied together, and the women had to push the men out there. And these people were not dumb when they got there. They're certainly not dumb now, but culturally speaking. So as far as talking to whales and dolphins, I think if they can make iPods and stuff like that, then I think we'll be able to talk to them.
Yeah, but by the way, on that subject, like, that is so incredibly true that it has actually shaped the way Bonnie and I are raising our children, because you realize, 10,000 years ago, what mattered to survive and thrive was being bigger than the other guy. 1,000 years ago, what mattered was being born to the right family and status. 100 years ago, what mattered was being smarter than the other guy. But nowadays, the number one thing that matters to thrive and survive is your ability to communicate effectively. We live truly in the
communication era. I was going to say twerking.
Yes, that too.
So, I think that, like, if we're going to other planets and we're finding interesting life forms, and they're not really have technology and you know, technology, I think that we could come up with some pretty rough rules as to what we would describe as that or not. I think we're not going to be, we might be just as poorly off trying to communicate with them. And also, it's like, whale song and stuff, it might have a lot of complex stuff. But, remember, bees shake their tail to tell other bees, where stuff is. And there's not
haven't we decoded some of the bee dance like you shake so much for this degrees west, and then this shakes so much for this is how far?
Yeah, but and the difference between whales and bees, and again, like with bees, but we know that, like, it's not like some guys that are making Breaking Bad version of a bee dance, And whales, that may be the case with whale song, is, we're seeing how these things work their way around, and we find whale songs kind of get evolved and change from, like, pod to pod. So there might be some sort of exchange there. But it is that thing, too. It's like, sometimes there's a gulf you just cannot cross because your experience level is so different.
I'll tell you what, I think about that all the time. Like, I keep picking up the idea, like, what if dolphins and whales separately, let's say we really are the third smartest species on the planet, and what if whales and dolphins were individually, even say light years beyond us in terms of ability of problem solving and reasoning and sense of self and culture and all these things, they're just defeated. They've never seen a star. They are by their very nature in an environment where they don't have opposable thumbs. And I marvel at the convenience of the fact that we happened to live on a planet where you can look up and see light that was generated a million years ago from a fusion generator across the galaxy or solar system or universe. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that we happen to have digits that allow us to build devices to manipulate ever smaller devices. I don't know, man. There's ever so often I look about it and it's like I buy the strong anthropic principle.
Yeah, I'm inclined to think that if we meet how we define intelligence, and that's weird because it's like, there could have been 100 million years ago, a super intelligent racist squid living in the ocean that, had complex language and everything else like that. But because of their environment, could have only have done so much. But the ability to make things that outlast us, or to make tools, and we tend to think of tools in a very narrowly defined thing, play, but, building things that last and have value outside of, for the user, building things with permanence, building things that communicate their use to others. These things make a big difference. And
well, and think about that. Like, part of the reason we know that early man was intelligent was because he carved things into rocks. There existed structures where you could make things that would last thousands of years. If we were as intelligent as we are right now, but found ourselves in the bodies of dolphins or whales, that you live in a strata where permanence does not exist. There's no way to make your mark on anything. Yeah, you everything is ephemera forever. That's kind of horrifying.
Well, but it's all in context, right? Like, for what we think of permanence would not be something that a dolphin would ever have any concept of, right?
Yeah,
like,
I,
Well, but let's say they did. Let's say they did understand that, and there's no way for you to etch anything. Let's say with your bottle nose, you were able to fashion some kind of tool that could carve stuff into the shifting sands at the bottom of the Atlantic. I mean, it is an entire environment where there's no way to pass your knowledge on. I mean, unless there's some kind of I guess we could have like an oral tradition among dolphins, but I don't know. I don't know. I can't crack that.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. It's in sitting here, I'm trying to think about like, we can certainly see examples of you have like the river dolphin. You have dolphins that can go into estuaries and other places where things erode. But beavers could build dams and stuff. And if there's it'd be interesting to see. Like, I wonder if like in shallow areas where they could push rocks around, whatever. If there ever was something to do some sort of rudimentary. It would not surprise me. It would amaze me, but it wouldn't surprise me if we found out, like, oh, they found out they can pool, they can pin in tuna or something like this and doing this. But I think you're absolutely right. The idea that, you leave something there and that water, that environment changes so quickly and, it's gone.
Think about it this way. They also live in an environment where even if, and again, let's say all of us to this day, with the benefit of hindsight, let's say all of humanity suddenly, there's some kind of left behind event. And all of humanity wakes up in dolphin bodies. We all know each other, and we could talk. We could communicate. We could squeak and squawk and communicate with each other. We remember radio waves and starlight and all of these things that make it up, but we lack the ability. Like, there's no way using bottle noses that you can create machinery that would – that would be able to access any of the physical things that we had as our like augmented information-gathering bodies.
Could you? I wonder. That's a great. So now you've laid down this premise. Now let's think about that. Like, I wonder, could you create a written language? Would you have? And I know so little about marine geology or whatever, but the idea, could you create something carving things or doing things in coral reefs or someplace like that? And of course, that will eventually grow over too. Rocks.
I mean, you can't smelt anything. You can't tie. I mean, I guess you could tie things together, but out of what? I guess out of seaweed.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think.
But using a bottle nose.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think on a very basic level. Like, what could you do if you picked up some sort of sharp implement or something? Could you? They might be weapons. You could get weapons and stuff, though. You could.
I mean, you could fashion spears of a sort, and you could maybe.
But I mean, like, would that be more effective than the weapon that is their own body? We have weapons. Weapons stay around because they are increasingly more effective than what we can do physically.
But you might do. You could think about things like, is there any advantage to? And again, I know a little about dolphin behavior in the wild, but like, grabbing.
Well, and by the way, the reason I keep thinking about all this is because there's postulates that say that the most likely place for us to find life in solar system is going to be beneath the ice of Europa. And let's say that there's a thriving culture of life underneath, thanks to geothermic heat being the source of everything. And let's say somehow they progressed beyond humans in intelligence with whatever it is. If it looks like our marine life, it's still, there's no way to express anything and make it permanent. You need to picture more like an octopod type of thing.
Yes.
where they have the ability to manipulate objects. But again, structurally, being underneath water, there's so many things you can't do and see.
I agree, but I wonder, but there's also things that we may not readily think about that you could do. Like, I think you might start building things that are more polymer-based and stuff, because how do things build, how do you build nests underwater? You grow shells, you do that. And so I wonder, it's an alien way to think about things, but it's curious. I remember seeing something about bottlenose dolphins or whatever using like sponges on their noses to go do stuff, like pushing them around. Cause like there certainly have been demonstrations where we see things where they can do some, pretty interesting things with very limited tools. But I think you're absolutely right. I always imagine if we're going to find some sort of really intelligent tool using underwater creature, it's going to be, some sort of cephalopod or something that has tentacles and stuff. And, you think about the idea of I thought about it, it'd be neat to write a story that takes place like 200,000 years ago with like highly intelligent squid interacting with people. And I thought about the idea of like, well, there are caves and there are places underwater or sea caves and stuff where they could have air environments that are still enclosed where they could build things or do other things, create things like fire or smelt or et cetera.
Oh, that's interesting. So to them, like, that's a laboratory. Like, they find these natural laboratories where they understand the properties inside this exotic thing that, you know, we would call air, but to them it's exotic matter that they're able to, you know, conduct experiments and create phenomena that utterly defy the their understanding of physics.
Yeah.
Well, I think that this lack of permanence, as far as Dolphins goes a long way to explaining why they haven't had a franchise quarterback since Dan Marino. I would also like to point out that this episode of the Weird Things Podcast is brought to you by Pretty Dead, the world's most scientifically accurate zombie movie that is available right now on video on demand in the U.S. and Canada. Pretty Dead details the story of Regina Stevens. She is slowly turning into a zombie, a member of the cannibalistic undead, rather. Struggling for absolute scientific and physiological accuracy, a new type of zombie was created based on actual fungal infections found in jungles and forests around the world, with a phenomenal acting led by up-and-comers Carly Oates and Regina Stevens and Ryan Shrogan as her unfortunate fiancé. Pretty Dead gives a unique look into the physical, emotional, and societal reactions of what could be a real-life zombie outbreak. So what you want to do is go over to prettydead.com or facebook.com/prettydeadmovie. And we thank Joe Cook and the cast and crew of Pretty Dead for being so patient, waiting for Weird Things Podcast for us to talk about the movie. So go ahead,
Andrew,
and support.
One quick thing before we move on, and I'm sure we are. But as far as permanence goes, what about etching in ice, where you have environments where ice is essentially persistent and super brittle, and you could take one piece of ice and carve something in another piece of ice? Would that enhance or change anything?
I think the problem there still is that even ice, ice really wouldn't last more than, you know, that surface, I don't think would last more than weeks, because you might have the overall size of it may not change, but you get processes where it melts on the bottom, comes to the top, or vice versa, whatever,
right.
Sort of the volume.
But that's how it is here on Earth. Let's pretend it's Europa. Could that maybe form the basis of it?
Let's say if we go on a much bigger scale, then yeah, I think so, absolutely. I think that if we say, I'm thinking like little tiny etchings, but yeah, if you get bottlenose dolphin that has a hot nose, that can melt stuff and can like a burrowing like
To evolve, that's amazing. To evolve the ability to manipulate. I love this.
That could be like, you could think of like evolutionary, you know, like, oh, what if we have these roughly solid surfaces overhead, but you could melt into it to go hide up there, to then to sneak out on prey or to avoid, you know, being hunted. You know, you could certainly think of a thing where you could evolve this sort of tool set, but then the idea of like, oh, well, I can carve little caves here. You know, I can carve this, and then.
Well, what if it was? What if that was okay? So picture this, all right? So you got your open ecosystems, and you have essentially an ant-like species that develops the ability to exothermically melt ice. You know, and so they build essentially ant colonies outward up into the ice of Europa to go to essentially deeper outward, and then from that you have some kind of evolutionary pressure to where you have various creatures that are able to with intentionality turn on and turn off their exothermic capabilities, and then I can see down the road you start carving stuff into ice tablets and you start etching stuff out. I could see something like that.
You might start some sort of like ice agriculture within the ice. I could say, and then I think that, you know, the thing that too is that a lot of things that we cannot do for ourselves, we've domesticated other animals to do for us.
Yes.
You know, so you get a dumb little squid that you can control or do whatever that, like, you know, you look at how ants will have other, you know, get aphids or whatever to do some of their work for them. And I think you could come up with cases.
Now think about this, Andrew. There's no reason for anyone to have eyes in this. So the you could have extraordinary fidelity if it's the type of thing where you could do like touch like a braille thing, or it more likely would be like an echolocation kind of thing where it's like they can see it, they would make noises, and they would be able to see with the from the reflections on there to where all of a sudden now you do, if, especially if they evolved to have tentacles or some ability to etch into that, where all of a sudden the whole planet itself, the shell, you know, in their culture, they'll call it, you know, the ceiling or whatever, you know, becomes covered in the history of all of their cultures. And as far as you go, essentially graffiti all around it becomes the way that the stories are passed on.
I'm never going to look at termite passages the same way again. Help us. Help us.
So, man, I'm sorry. I sort of sidetracked us on a weird flight of fancy there. I don't know. I'm fascinated by that, Bo.
Well, and keeping to that on a alternate sort of flight of fancy, there was another interesting article about back in the 1920s when aviation first started to take off, literally. The problem was, as you look at the present technology and its inherent limitations, you just tend to imagine that that's the future's going to kind of be more of the same, not realizing that you get some innovations that just move you way forward. So with aircraft, limited fuel supplies, the power of the engine ratio to the rest of the craft was somewhat limited. That's why, like, you know, Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic was such a big deal, because it was like barely enough fuel, barely powerful enough to do that. You know, now more fuel efficient engines with more power, better ways to store fuel. Right.
And also the technology for like de-icing planes and that kind of stuff. There was an astonishing amount of luck in Lindbergh's flight.
Yeah. So these things, like, that's a great point. It's like they have these, all these little things you didn't even consider. So the idea, the prospect of the average citizen flying across the Atlantic, let alone the Pacific, was a pretty daunting idea, because the Atlantic is pretty sparse when it comes to islands. You know, you got Bermuda down towards the middle, you know, in the south sort of the northern hemisphere. But other than that, not a whole lot of places, unless you want to take a route that curves around Iceland, Greenland, New Brunswick, et cetera, which is kind of, you know, where they tended to follow back then anyway. If you wanted to go right across the Atlantic, problem. So this had people speculating the idea of, what if we put, you know, what we would kind of think of maybe as an aircraft carrier today, but what if we built a bunch of artificial islands that were landing strips so that you would cross the Atlantic and hop? So you'd hop to one.
So wait, this was proposed back in the 1920s?
Back in the 20s.
Wow. I'm sure at the time that was probably in the 1920s. I'd like to picture a version of the 1920s Weird Things podcast where instead of arguing about space elevators, they're arguing about what's the best way. So-and-so wants to make a plane that can just go across the Atlantic in one jump. That's crazy. Why don't we build a series of islands that anyone can get across?
And that's, you know, and that was the thinking up until, you know, the technology said no. And then I think like we're kind of like, you know, probably like that right now when we'll cover in a moment, you know, the latest SpaceX test. But you think about the idea of what if we did pursue that route? What if we did build some big platforms and big places? And, you know, I don't know what to
I have to feel like it. The justification for that would be, here is X, which is our current ability to fly power. And the fact that X is less than Y, which is the distance over the Atlantic, is why we need, you know, solution, you know, Proposition 193 to build a bunch of islands, right? Uh-huh. I gotta feel like the march forward of increasingly superior technology would happen regardless. And I gotta feel like, let's say we even did that. Weirdly, I think making that Atlantic highway, as they might call it, would be would delay the progress of planes, because they have a solution. And so I think it would kick backward aerospace or aeronautics for like 30 years.
Well, but that's assuming that it like has a certain kind of economic benefit, right? Like that the process and investment for which isn't so onerous that, you know, plane flight is a more needed solution to it.
Well, so picture this. So picture somebody says, we, you know, let's say there's some need where all of a sudden it's extraordinarily urgent that we get some kind of, let's say there's some rare material that originates in France and we need it in the United States and it has to get here in less than 6 weeks or 2 weeks or whatever the number is to where it becomes profitable to set up this before we have the flight capability to make it across the Atlantic. So we build this infrastructure, we make all these islands, and we set up this chain of whatever this mysterious stuff is.
Right. Just say mail. How about mail?
Okay, fine. It's just that mail's not so urgent, but okay. Fine. So let's say mail suddenly becomes super urgent and we need this flight. Once that structure's there, how much is the fact that that's what we do now limits us from moving beyond it?
Well, the reason I brought up mail was one of the primary drivers of air travel and transportation, because wanting to pay to get something from London to New York in an expedient manner, you know, when you weren't as worried about the weight of it as much as the content of it.
Yeah.
So I would. I don't hear. So my answer to that is that it would depend. Like, if it was a big government endeavor to do that, what the resource drain would be from the private enterprise? Because you'd still, the beautiful thing, as we know about markets, is people can say, "Well, go do your foolhardy thing over here. We're going to go do our foolhardy thing here, and we'll see who's the least foolhardy." And I think there could be. I think if we were building, if you had the major companies that were going to become, you know, aircraft builders or at that time and all that, said, yeah, no, this is the future of it. I think you're right. I think it would have delayed things or could have been problematic, as we've seen in other cases too. You know, I think the idea of just, you know, the ideas of transportation we'd want to use at that point, which, you know, mail, et cetera. The idea that if the Postal Service said, no, we're going to build this big, huge platform because we need it to get stuff back and forth and we can make it pay for itself, I think, yeah, we would be building, you know.
You know what? I guess back to the theme of mail, what you're kind of describing is what happened with the Pony Express, right? Because the Pony Express was short-term, high-speed carriers in the form of horses that they set up a series of stops, i.e. islands in this scenario, and it eventually got defeated, I think it got defeated by the fact that locomotives were able to is that what killed it, or just wasn't profitable?
The Pony Express was only around for about 3 years. It was a telegraph.
Oh, the telegraph, right, because it was a more efficient distribution method. Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, it was one of those things where we had this neat model and the telegraph comes along. But yeah, I think there are a lot of examples if we start to think about it where you put in that standard and that standard becomes the way it has to be done. And then, you know, it's you kind of rule out anything else.
Well, but like, all right, so let's say you have these islands, right? And you can get from London to New York in a certain amount of time by driving. If that went off without a hitch and there were no problems, you know, and it became in its own way an efficient model, yet it, you know, retarded the development of the next great gigantic leap forward, then yeah, I think, but aren't those cases fairly rare? I mean, like, is what would be a case of something that worked great and worked economically for everybody involved, but was just not the big thing and maybe kept.
Well, I mean, we already see it. To be honest, it's always difficult to see these things when you're in the middle of it. But for example, let's take the interstate system right now. We all agree that the interstate system is the best way to get from point A to point B because we all have cars and we get on the interstate and it's very fast. However, or better yet, let's take, you know, who knows what might have been possible if we all decided that flying was the best way to get around. Likewise, we all agree that phone systems, in fact, phone systems are the perfect example. Phone systems were decided were so much faster, so much better, so much higher fidelity that everybody decided there needed to be one phone system and everyone needed to be on it. But and that we needed to subsidize running, you know, physical copper to the last mile of random farms. You know, everybody in the city needed to pay more so that we could get copper all the way to these rural areas. Who's to say that if that didn't happen, there might have been a wireless revolution, you know, the ability, somebody might have created a protocol, might have invented compression and digital management might have happened even earlier, digital switching.
Well, that's, you know, it's a curious question. You know, the biggest leap, you know, with the transistor, you know, was the discovery of, you know, silicon making a great semiconductor, which allowed you to make these really tiny switches. And I'm actually pulling up right now because I'm trying to remember, like, it sat around in science journals for years before somebody, you know, for Shockley et al. Said, you know, let's build a smaller vacuum tube out of this, because once you could do really, really tiny switching, and I want to find the date on that because it'd be kind of curious, because it would be a thing like that we would have, if somebody said, well, let's find a simpler way to go wireless, and we need to make the hardware work. So let me see.
By the way, I read I can't remember if it was in the Master Switch or something else, but there's apparently some interesting controversy about the transistor where forgive me, I've forgotten all of the names. All I remember is the story because our stupid primate brains love to remember stories. But the story was that there was one guy whose research got started, kind of hinted at what transistors could do. He left the picture. Two other guys kind of developed it, and because they felt like they owed something to their professor, they included him on the paper, and then all of a sudden transistors start to explode, and all of a sudden the professor who started it starts showing up at every photo op, standing between them, wedging his way back in so he could go back to owning this theory that he had a while ago that really these two other guys made. I hate being so stupid. Why can't I be connected to the internet at all times in my brain?
Thing to say, Brian. You know, in the history of the semiconductor development from the transistor, I don't remember the name, I'm an idiot. Come on. So it's interesting. It's like what I did not know is I'm pulling this up, the early history of semiconductors. Just for the lay people out there, what made the big leapfrog in technology with is being able to store information or have little tiny switches was made possible when you realized you could use silicon, just the smallest amount of it, give it a little bit of a current, and it could either keep a gate open or closed, which is what allowed you to make those vacuum tubes shrink one first to the size of something the size of a eraser on a pencil, and then now where you have billions of them in your pocket in your phone. And some of the first people documenting, you know, some of the semiconductor effects is you had Faraday with silver sulfide back in 1833. Even Alexander Bell was using stuff in his photophone transmitter stuff. So you had early on people do that. But there was like, you don't see anybody whose name you associate with computation looking at this and saying, hey, wait a second, this is a small switch.
Yes. That's out of my ballpark. That's smarter than me. You did it, Andrew. You elevated the discussion out of my range.
It's smarter than all of us. I'm saying that would have been curious, would be because, like, you know, you look at the growth of computation and then electronics, and they're actually pretty further apart, and really until the 1930s or 40s when they started saying we could use these things to do these things. And then, but if you'd had that earlier on, it would have been curious. To that, I say, I have no answer.
All right, so I'll tell you, I've had two thoughts that are very weird thingsy, and I'm going to let you guys choose which one that I could propose, or you could tell me to shut up.
The weird one.
I don't know which one's weirder, okay? One is totally hypothetical and has no basis in reality, but it's a really good would-you-rather scenario. And the other is something based in a news story that happened today that made me wonder what stuff would look like.
Let's start with the would-you-rather.
Okay. Would you rather – you know, we all have scenarios where we wish we could be younger or go back in time or all these things. And I was thinking about how we are a unique generation in that – we are the first generation in all of humanity's history where advances in technology seem to be keeping pace, and of course this is the basis of the singularity or whatever, with the aging of our bodies. And I came up with a very practical question that I surprised myself with the answer, which is, if you could suddenly be 10 years younger, like I'm 38 right now, if I wanted to, could I be 28, all of my machinery working super well, my knees don't hurt when I run, I've got, you know, 10 more years to advance my career, and let's say for grins, I get to take Bonnie with me, and all of a sudden, 10 more years younger, same day, and we don't lose our children, just all of a sudden, I look better, and I just added 10 years of the best years of my life to my body, just like that, with no downside, except for the fact that technology gets knocked back 20 years, and we don't, and it will take 20 years to get back to where we are technologically. So that means no iPhones. That means no cell phones. That means internet is text based. There's barely the World Wide Web is 12, you know, research firms. You have to dial up internet. Nobody has cell phones because it's something that you got to be a rich Wall Street guy to do. And it will take 20 years to get back to the iPhone and the world that we live in now, would you take it? Now, keep in mind, you're not making everybody 10 years younger. You're making yourself and, say, your one significant other. You guys get to snap back and you get to be younger. And the rest of the world won't know the difference as far as technology. It will progress exactly as it did before. But you essentially lose nothing that matters to you emotionally. You physically get 10 of the best years that you've ever had given back to you. But the only penalty is that, and again, you're the only one who knows different, you lose all of the trappings of your laptop is now ridiculous. There's no graphical user interface in most of your computers. Would you take that? And I was astonished to realize that that not only would I not, but I'm looking forward to being, 78 years old and alive. Even though my machinery is totally busted, I will be capable of much more at age 78 than I am now at age 38.
I'm confident that technology will continue to progress. Whether or not at 78 I'll be in better shape or same shape that I am now, I don't know. I hope so, but I have reasons to think that sometimes these problems can be harder than we realize.
Keep in mind, I'm not saying I'll be healthier at 78. At 78, I'll be barely hanging on to life as a thread. I will have sincerely degraded cartilage. I'll have cancers all over my body. I'll have even brain tumors or whatever. Okay. But I'll be capable of more because of the technological advancements.
So yeah, I mean, like, I'm in the best health of my life right now. So like. Like last 10 years, I exercised a bit, I did whatever, but like I've been in like the last year, I've gotten a much better health, much better shape, much better health than I've ever been before. And so like for me, I look back, I'm like, the last 10 years, it's like I got a few more gray hairs, my skin's, not as perky and young as it used to be, but like I feel better than I did even 10 years ago, to be honest.
You know what? That's a good point. I feel like it's a flawed thought experiment now because I'm asking it to a bunch of guys in our 30s, and none of us are close to
you're getting off. Too. I mean,
yeah. We
have this point where you talk to girls and they'll be like, there's a great peak period that we're just getting into where girls go, right? Look at girls love Robert Downey Jr. He's older than all of us. Johnny Depp, older than all of us. Brad Pitt. Older than all of us.
Jimmy Buffett.
There you go.
Nobody likes Jimmy Buffett.
Ah, girls love him. This is a no-brainer. I mean, granted, for me, it's the difference between 30 and 20. And as much fun as my 20s were, they were fun then, Like, I don't know if, in knowing where I am now, if I would even necessarily find my 20s as fun.
No, but keep in mind, you get to keep your experience.
No, that's the problem. The problem is I get to keep my experience. And now
you have to hang out with 20-year-olds.
And I like where I'm at. So it's like, and now the things that I enjoyed doing or were open and really wanted to do when I was 20 through 29, are things
At your age, Justin, you could be... you speak very eloquently, you're very sharp, and you're very well-reasoned in all of your arguments, and you happen to be 30 years old. Can you imagine talking the way you do as what to outside appearances look like a 20-year-old? You would be a wunderkind. You would have your own television talk show instantly.
I don't know if that would – because I talked fairly eloquently for my age then. It didn't really get me much, Andrew's known me since I was 16, I think I am a bit wiser in general, but I've always been somebody that's been able to talk a fairly good game. And that's, I don't know. It's like, to me, I'm with you, with both of you to a certain extent. And the idea that the momentum of where technology is way more important to me. To give up 20 years of that, would be, I don't know. I kind of feel like if we are to believe in the singularity, that we are, we are scrambling up to the roof of Saigon, looking for the last helicopter. You know, this we might barely overlap with some amazing medical technologies that could, you know, make what we think to
what
be life
an
extension.
Amazing metaphor. Can I just step back and, sir, I applaud you. Oh my God. Please continue, but that was incredible.
I mean, imagine that came out of the fucking mouth of a 20-year-old. I should bleep that.
It's doubly incredible because I just my friend Dr. James Lohaus is a nuclear physicist who was educating me on the entire saga of Cambodia. So it's a little weird for you to hit something so close to what I just spent the last hour having my mind blown over.
I mean, I'm just saying that's awesome. And, you know, it's funny. The New York Times ran a thing about the iPhone and you know, the process by which the iPhone became a reality and the people that worked on it and everything. And so I went back and I watched that keynote, that full hour and a half initial iPhone keynote, which is
the one with the where he promises three new devices, the best iPod ever, a communications device,
a widescreen touch iPod, a revolutionary new phone, and a an internet communicator, the likes of which we'd never seen. But even then, before that, you know, it is a time capsule of that era. It's like, hey, let's debut the new dancing shadow iPod ad. And like, let's talk about how we switched to Intel chips, where it's like, do you guys think even Apple, if Apple decided to make a big shift in chipsets for desktops and laptops, that it would be something even like keyworthy now? I mean, like, or would be like as big as that announcement, which led that whole keynote, was, you know, the progress report on switching to Intel chipsets, just because laptops and desktop aren't where they are or where they were then now. But that idea, to go back to that, which was like 10 years ago, is crazy pants. To go 20 years from then is just, I don't think that that's something that I can deal with, even for a decade.
Even for the benefit of no, and let's take it as a given, just for grins. Let's say it's as a given that all three of us would benefit immensely in whatever it is we're doing. All of a sudden, you would be regarded. You would have, as far as your career goes, you'd be able to do more. As far as your, you know, your home sex life goes, you'd be able to do more. Everyone would find you more attractive. It sounds like all three of us would give that opportunity up just to not have to go 20 years back on the technology ride.
I'm not making that up because of the technology thing, though. I mean, that's just, if you just said, if you just said, do you want to go jump back, be 10 years younger? Like, the only thing I would say yes is like, okay, my incidence of cancer, things like that go up, you know, every decade. So for that, I'd be like, okay, for that, it would be the reason I would consider it. And so, I mean, maybe for that alone, just the less likelihood, you know, of disease or something like that. But I guess, you know, that would be the reason for it. But the technology thing, I don't know.
For me, it's the reverse. Like to me, the guy inside who's upstairs pulling the controls in my brain, that person is so entranced and in love with the changing pace of technology in our world, and more specifically with the rapidly increasing change of pace. You know, we're all accustomed to new revolutions every 6 months. I couldn't give that up for 20 years. I couldn't, well, because think about
but
it this
here,
way.
But Brian, let me say for you in terms of your vitality as a human, you're running triathlons now. You're going on 100-mile bike rides. That's not something you were doing in 10 years ago, right? Like, I mean, like, you are in more of a vital health thing perspective now. So, I mean, I guess would part of your argument be that you could bring that revelation of your dedication to physical health?
I mean, understand, 10 years ago? like, I mean, and part of that is a function of where we are right now. You know, we are at a generally healthy phase in the you know, in the distribution of your lifespan. But understand at the heart
it's
of this,
also the
I'm
fact
really
that you
asking,
got off the road. Because I'll tell you what. Like, when I was hanging out in Florida, I'm running all the time, running at 3 o'clock in the morning, running in the afternoon, best shape of my life. I get on the road, nothing but Wendy's. Wendy's all day, laying like
it's
a beached whale.
It's awful. But understand, separate from how you feel now and how you would like to feel 10 years younger or whatever, I'm saying flat out, you could either, what if I framed the exact same question this way? I can make you guaranteed live 10 years longer than your set lifespan. But in exchange for 10 more years of real life added to the bottom line, you have to right now jump back 20 years. In 20 years, you'll catch up to where we are now. And when you die, you will die not having seen what that additional 10 years would have been if you had died. Or let me frame it this way. You could die 10 I will wave my wand and you are definitely going to die 10 years earlier, but you'll get to see technology go 10 years beyond what you would have seen right now.
So just 10 years tacked on to the end of your life?
No. 10 of the best years because I'm making you younger now. And so now, you will die at age 90 looking like an 80-year-old, but technology, you will not get to see that 10 extra years of technology, or you will die at 70 looking like an 80-year-old, or you'll say you'll die at 70 looking like a 70-year-old, but you get to see what technology would have looked like were you 90.
I'm working on a diagram here to chart.
Yeah, all right, yeah.
Well, I guess
you carry the one. Is the D silent?
I'm asking as many different versions of the same question as possible to see if it changes anything for you guys.
I don't know. I don't think that. Yeah, I think I'm still. Here's what I very much believe. I want to run out the last second on the play clock that is my life, with the hope that my consciousness lives forever by way of technology.
All right, well, then if that's the case, you would take...
No, because I'm losing 10 years of innovation.
20 years of innovation.
No. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like that's... correct.
So I want the innovation.
Yeah.
I want the farthest the innovation can go.
Okay, now what about this? So does that mean if I... Same wand... I wave it, and now you jump straight from 30 to 40, but technology jumps 20 years in the future. You would take that?
Maybe.
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean that's essentially a different version of the exact same question. Because I don't know that I would jump. Man, that's weird. I don't know that I would jump from 38 to 48 just to see technology jump 20 years in the future.
Well, I'm thinking 20 years in the future, they're going to have some, my Neutrogena skin stuff's going to get a lot better. I think cancer, treatments are going to be like amazing compared to now. I think, sure, okay.
You
guys sounded a lot less excited about this version of the same question.
Well, we're saying that whatever gets us closer to the future is what we want.
Yeah. The future as designed by, technology.
Yeah, the technological future. We're okay with that. I'll take the bet that going forward and losing 10 years but getting 20 years of advanced technology probably would close a lot of that gap as long as I'm kind of stay healthy.
I believe in the promise of a technological future the way that devout Christians believe in heaven. I just hope I can get there. I hope I can get there.
All right. Well, let me ask my other question, and then I'm done with my, because I came armed with a bunch of thoughts that were running around in my head. you guys saw these self-assembling cubes from MIT this week, right?
I actually did not. I heard them being discussed on Tech News today, but I did not see them.
So basically they are individual cubes that move like most, as they say in the MIT thing, they say most robots are built for stability and the ability to essentially walk or whatever. These are just cubes with a flywheel inside. And they figured out that if they spin the flywheel up to about 20,000 RPM and then stop it, it'll essentially jump forward. And they also figured out that if they put magnets all over it, then they could jump a block from one section to another section. And if it missed, then, it would just make another jump to correct and it basically Mexican jumping beans in little cube forms. And that so essentially they created these little Tetris looking blocks that would jump from park to park. It's very slow, But fascinating to watch. If you just look at the, you know, self-assembling robots MIT, I'm sure you'll find it. But I was thinking in terms of, like, they have suggested that if it were sufficiently miniaturized, these are the kind of things that could form the basis for a vaguely liquid-like polymer that could self-organize and re-transform into like a T-1000 type of thing, which, by the way, not the best sales pitch on MIT's.
Yeah, I vote no. There's a thing that came out. Like, remember the thing Big Dog, the robot that walks like...
Yeah.
They've got a version of that that just runs like a cheetah now. It's scary. They've got, you know, a bipedal army shows this bipedal thing walking across, uneven surfaces. And I put a thing on Twitter the other day because, like, I was like kind of kidding, but I'm kind of half serious. I want an MMA fighting style to help us fight off robots.
Yes.
Because I'm thinking, like, you know, we figure, like, all right, well, their balance sensors are going to be here. You got to kick it here. Or, you know, we need to have a taser that just is a 100,000-volt taser that takes these things out. I'm ready. I'm a little scared now. I need to figure out how to defend myself against killer robots.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think because I was thinking about it, it'd be kind of interesting. You see some of these military robots, and we have this sort of idea of this super smart intelligence making these things. But, like, you know, what if it's like, you know, and I'm sure there's like a billion video games on this premise, but what if it's like, you know, there's a few factories, some, like, you know, build all fab labs, whatever, gets taken over by a computer, just pumping out a bunch of humanoid robots, kind of like T-800 style, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's like, all right, I can kind of maybe take one of those things on, you know, a little bit prepared. You know, liquid metal dudes, no, I'm done. You know, full-on nanotech, shapeshift or whatever, I give up now.
Yeah. Well here's the...
Welcome our new robot overlords. Yeah.
Like here's the part that stuck in my mind was because these particular robots look to be each individual cube is about the size like a letter block that you would see a kid play with. So something you can hold in your hand. So I was imagining, like, in the demonstration, they only have like 6 or 8 of them. So it can pretty much only form Tetris pieces. But then I was imagining, like, what if you had 100,000 of them? And it's like, you know, theoretically, they could all form into some kind of giant bipedal thing or maybe take the shape of a skyscraper or maybe build their own machinery. So it's like they've got their low fidelity objects, but it seems like if they can continuously reform into whatever tool you needed, I was wondering, let's say they did become intelligent, how much manipulation, kind of like the dolphin problem, how much manipulation of the outside world could they have with such large, fumbly fingers?
You ever see the movie Demon Seed?
No.
So Demon Seed was based on a...
I would love if that was part of an MIT research paper, though. Like, that's just like the fourth paragraph in. Do you ever see the movie Demon Seed?
So he, Dean Koontz wrote the story, and it's about this. This was like 1977. The scientist builds this really smart AI, and let's just say things go awry. But it's totally worth watching to get to the end because it has this kind of a different sort of take on stuff, which I dug. It was actually a pretty neat take on the idea of maybe malevolent AI with certainly acts malevolent.
Man, I feel like you're dancing around a spoiler that you don't want to tell us. Maybe I'll watch it so I can know what you're talking about.
Well, I'll tell you what. That's a great segue since we are over an hour into our picks.
Yes. I don't know. I got nothing. I'm reading. Last week, Justin, you recommended the Mr. Show thing, and I'm halfway through that.
Yeah,
I started The Information, and what I have not started is Peter F. Hamilton's new one. The that's a phone ringing. Was The Great North Road? Is that what it is, Andrew?
Yeah.
As Tom Merritt described on last week's twit. He has been reading it for most of his life now.
is it? I mean, have any of you guys read it? Because, like, I've loved everything else that Peter Hamilton's done.
I've not read it. Have you, Andrew?
I started it, and it kind of goes on and on and on. And I kind of got a little bit, I have a much shorter attention span too when it comes to audiobooks now. So, you know, that's, I put on me, but I was just, it's just this, you know, the domestic house life of one of the detectives, you know, working on this case, just kind of like, and it's like, and I'm like, I'm one of these things like, I guess this is going to be important later on, but Jesus Christ, I don't need this level of detail.
Well, okay. Well, as far as my picks, I actually don't have one, but those are the three things I'm reading right now. I can report that my favorite part of the Mr. Show book so far is the outtakes where they clearly messed up and decided to leave them in because they're hilarious. The information I've barely gotten into, and next week I'll report on my experience with the Great North Road.
Yeah, I started, you know, a thing that I gave up on before, but then I picked up again, which I'm now kind of getting back into, is the Leviathan Wakes.
What is that?
So it's a series by James Corey, and actually I think that's actually been picked up for development in a film or television. And it basically takes place, it's a big space operatic sort of thing, but takes place within our solar system. So it's kind of, you know, I like that.
It's within the realm of reality. There's no magic warp or hyperspace or anything.
Within technology we can understand, but, you know, a kind of a distant future thing, which is an idea that's fascinated me for something I've been wanting to develop for a long time. And I started this thing before, and it felt kind of like a lot like other stuff, but a lot of people just love and rave about it. And so it's the part of the series called The Expanse. And so I'm, you know, I'm reading it so far, and so I'm not hating it, so...
Put that on the cover. Andrew May doesn't hate it.
That's Leviathan Wakes?
Yeah, Leviathan Wakes. It's on Audible. So, but that's not my pick.
What's your pick?
My pick? I don't know if I picked this on here before, but I went back and I watched it a few weeks ago, and I just absolutely loved Time Bandits.
Oh, my God. You realize Time Bandits is like deep in my heart. It means so much to me. It's so weird and so bizarre. I tried to show it to my daughters, but it's too weird for them. I adore that story. Sean Connery, Shelley Duvall, bunch of little people, the gates that were alleged to be the foundation for Richard Garriott's moon gates in the Ultima saga. Love that movie. And plus, it was put together by what's that Beatle? George Harrison's company, and Terry Gilliam
he directed it, right?
Yeah,
yeah. So Terry Gilliam directed it. George Harrison put the money into it, and actually has the end title song. There was an article that came out a little while ago just how hard it was to get the whole thing made, and it actually was written by Gilliam and Michael Palin. So it's just a fun movie, and there's been rumors of a remake, but whatever.
Dude, you'll never do better than David Warner as evil. I would have started with Digital Watches, day one.
Yeah, you know who was their first choice was Jonathan Pryce.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But they got Warner. Yeah, Warner just nailed it as evil.
Warner is exquisite, man. That started his run as every bad guy in every movie ever.
Yeah. So I recommend Time Bandits. I think if you've never seen it, you know, it's a fun 80s movie. It was a surprise hit, and just you know, it's just delightful and fun. I'll just put it that way.
Well, delightful and fun would be the antonyms to how I would describe my pick, Devil in the Grove, which is a story about specifically Central Florida and the Deep South, and the career of the lawyer Thurgood Marshall as he worked with the NAACP in cases in the Jim Crow South, and specifically the trial of the Groveland Boys, which happened outside of Orlando, the Orlando area, and is horrifyingly screwed up. Like, I'll just say this. There comes a point in which a Supreme Court case is argued, and you would have to think that, well, this is the end of the legal system, is the Supreme Court makes a decision and then things happen. And that's about halfway through the book. And what follows is kind of heartbreaking. And it is all made all the more, affecting when you know and have been to and have spent time in the names of the towns that they are talking about. And specifically the kind of structure that was in place in terms of the police departments and stuff like that. But It's a really good book. It won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction last year, and I highly recommend it. The audiobook reading is very, very good, and it left me wanting more stories told in that era with those.
All right, this is the Weird Things podcast. You could go ahead and explain your vision for what you wanted, Justin. I want
a Mad Men era fictionalized television series where a fictional version of Thurgood Marshall goes from town to town and argues these cases, because I think it also
gets crazy laid on the road.
Well, I mean, this is something that is a part, and I probably read far more into than the author meant to. I mean, he puts in there so as to make it clear, like, but euphemisms like he spent a lot of time on the road and his marriage lost the love that it once had.
and Justin immediately thinks like, oh man, he was getting laid.
Well, and he makes a point to, as tastefully as one can about somebody who is such a important historical figure like Thurgood Marshall is, makes the point that he was no stranger to having affairs on the road. But I think that, listen, he was a big, important, complex man in history. And I think that there is room in today's culture, in this era of this golden age of television that we find ourselves in, that you can have a fictionalized version of somebody like that, that meant a lot to the civil rights movement, but is not, you know, Jesus delivered from the heavens. That is a man who, you know, was of great import and made great change, but was not a perfect person, as none of us are.
You know, Cool Hand Luke was set in Florida roughly around that time period.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
There's you can still go see the like where the prison was supposed to have been, etc. But you know, it was shot somewhere else, but it was based on Florida.
There was a point in the book where they talk about some screwed up things happening in Apopka, Florida, which is a town just outside of Orlando that me and Andrew spent a fair amount of time in a couple years ago. That I was just like, wow, that's, you mean the place with the Panda Express and the Walmart? That's crazy.
Things change.
All right. Well, there's my pick.
Well,
there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, the Weird Things podcast. I've got to say, it's been pretty weird.